mix. And I'll also be playing choral music by Janáček and a setting of the Stabat Mater by the young British composer Matthew Martin. All that and more next Sunday from 9 o'clock. I'm James Jolly and I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music this morning. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production today by Neil Miners.
In staging and in accepting this Scottish referendum, the UK as a whole has come a very long way. But where exactly have we arrived?
Professor Linda Colley returns to BBC Radio 4.
On September the 18th, over 45% of the population of one part of the UK voted for independence. So the possibility of crisis in the future is emphatically there.
Analysing the impact of the Scottish referendum after the vote on Tuesday morning at 9 over on BBC Radio 4.
And now, Private Passions. As part of the jazz season across radios 3 and 2 for the London Jazz Festival, Michael Barclay's guest is crime writer, poet and jazz enthusiast John Harvey.
My guest today, John Harvey, has no shortage of fans, and a peculiar lot they sometimes turn out to be. His prize-winning books have sold over a million copies and have been translated and published all over the world. His Nottingham detective, Charlie Resnick, is now so well known, after 12 novels, 2 television adaptations and 4 radio plays, that he seems like a real person, a brooding, solitary, sensitive man who has a passion for listening to jazz. And this is where the fans come in. Because, John, I think they send you compilation tapes of the kind of jazz tracks that they think Resnick would enjoy. Pretty bizarre in some ways, but perhaps rather flattering and interesting too.
I think it's both of those, both flattering and bizarre. I noticed it first on book tours in America when there was a clear gender divide. The women readers would be interested in Resnick's Cats, but the male readers would kind of, you know, sidle up to me with what in those days were compilation cassettes and more latterly compilation CDs of music they thought Charlie would like to listen to.
So do you enjoy these compilations?
Oh, yes, heavens, yes, because it's usually a mixture of things that I know and things I haven't heard before. So it's really nice to go home and listen to them. And it's nice to think, you know, that you're writing about something that's making that kind of connection. And, you know, woe betide you if you don't mention the Cats or if you don't have Resnick listening to Thelonious Monk at some point, because you'll get emails.
So if he was suddenly to become gay, change the Cats for a dog and start listening to country and Western, you would have trouble on your hands.
I think I'd have trouble on my hands from my publisher and editor before the readers even got close.
You're very specific about the pieces he listens to, and we might hear something that has been very specific to you to start off with, I think, ever since you were a boy.
Yes, I mean, at home, we listened to music on the radio mainly. My father loved piano. Sunday afternoons were sacrosanct for Semprini, old ones, new ones, loved ones, neglected ones. But he did have a Fats Waller record of Alligator Crawl and Viper's Drag. And that was what led me into jazz, but that was the only one we had at home. Fortunately, I had a good friend whose parents had an excellent collection of jazz on 78s. And that was when I first listened to Billie Holiday and Billie Holiday with Lester Young.
So tell me just about this particular number.
Mean to Me was one of probably the first of Billie's songs I ever heard. What I liked immediately was the contrast between her kind of almost perky diction and the lyric itself. I thought that seemed to me to work particularly well, rather better than in later life when, you know, her voice was falling apart, was fairly dilapidated, and it was at one with the lyric. Here, I think they're quite contrasting, and for me, that works better. ¶¶
It must be great fun to be mean to me. You shouldn't, for can't you see what you mean to me?
The close musical relationship that comes through, I think, on that recording between Lester Young, who's playing the tenor saxophone, and Billie Holiday, continued through both of their careers. And I was really interested and amused by the moment in the recent David Hare television play, Page 8, when Bill Nye, wanting to impress the young lady in the next door apartment, takes along a YouTube clip of Billy and Lester playing together as a kind of example of what a true relationship can be.
Billie Holiday singing Mean to Me with Lester Young on saxophone, both ably supported by Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. Mean to Me was recorded in 1937, before you were born, John.
But, only just.
Yeah, but music you discovered, nevertheless, as a boy. So there was quite a bit of music in your childhood by the sound of it. Was it the kind of family that you were perhaps expected to do something like write or...
Well, it was an odd family. It was a small family in that way. It was my father and my mother and myself. But my mother's family had all been involved in the theatre. I had two great aunts, and indeed my mother's mother, had all acted, they'd sung. In fact, the story goes that my father met my mother when she was doing an amateur performance at a working men's club in North London and sang Alice Blue Gown, and that was the beginning of it. But, you know, I never heard her sing. She never sang around the house. She never played music. She hardly ever referred to it. It was my father, Semprini, Fats Waller and so on. So for other kinds of music, you know, I've been eternally grateful that I went to the school I went to, which was St Aloysius in Highgate, a grammar school then, a comprehensive now, because I was the first one practically in the playground and the last one out. It was my family, my extended family, and that's where I first listened to classical music.
Well, the next choice isn't jazz, it's Mendelssohn, the Hebrides Overture.
Yes, we had a classical music club at the school, which simply meant that we would go along after school, a couple of dozen of us, and one of the music teachers would play records. And once a month, he would take us off to live concerts at Hornsey Town Hall. So Tintagel by Arnold Bax, I remember, and then this particular piece, the Fingal's Cave or the Hebrides Overture by Mendelssohn.
Thank you.
that's such a vivid piece of music and such a vivid memory of listening to that. I mean, you know, without exaggeration, it takes me back to when I was, what would I have been, 13 or 14, sitting in my green school blazer in a very ordinary classroom, being transported by that music.
Mendelssohn's The Hebrides Overture, or Fingal's Cave, performed by the Moscow Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Maxim Shostakovich, son of Dmitri, whose music we'll be hearing later in the programme. Music that inspired John Harvey as a teenager. So that was what you were listening to in the music clubs at school, but what were you going to hear in the evenings? Because, again, I think that was jazz, and this was the late 50s, so jazz clubs weren't there springing up everywhere across London. Quite an exciting time.
Very exciting time for us teenagers. It was pre-rock and roll. So what you did was get yourself off to the local jazz club. I mean, for instance, the Fishmonger's Arms at Wood Green every Sunday evening. It was where you got to meet your friends, meet girls, very important if you went to a boys' grammar school, drink beer, and just generally, you know, have a great time. The only problem was there were so many jazz clubs around within reach that it got slightly out of hand, I suppose, after a while. And I spent more time going off to jazz clubs than I did with my studies.
It did slightly take over your academic work, didn't it?
Well, I have to say, I'm probably one of the few people who took an A-level and then resat it and got a lower mark the second time. So, yes, probably all those nights walking home at kind of one in the morning from the jazz club in Oxford Street without having done my homework. I hope my younger daughter is listening to this. Didn't do me a lot of good. Yes, it did mean that, you know, I left school, shall we say, one of the less well qualified.
You used to play a bit in a band, didn't you?
I used to play drums mostly when I was at college. I went to Goldsmiths and I played in a band there for 3 years or so and have played a little bit off and on ever since, but never been very good.
One of the first major jazz pianists next, and an interesting character who perhaps we don't know enough about.
James P. Johnson, yes. I mean, I only knew of him as the father of stride piano.
Where the left hand jumps absurd distance.
That's right. And which, you know, you hear right through the history of jazz piano, you know, from Waller to Duke Ellington, right up to Thelonious Monk. They all have a very strong sense of a stride left hand. And it was only last year when the South Bank Centre in London had a year-long festival based on Alex Ross's book, The Rest Is Noise. And as part of that, Marin Alsop conducted a concert of American music, Rhapsody in Blue, the things you would expect. And then at the end of the evening, she put in this incredible piece, short piece of symphonic music by James P. Johnson, which was absolutely thrilling to listen to, about which I'd know nothing. I had no idea that he wrote symphonic music, that he co-wrote an opera with Langston Hughes, that he had anything of that side of music in him.
Thank you. Marin Alsop conducting the Concordia Orchestra in James P. Johnson's Victory Stride. Actually, she founded the Concordia Orchestra to play jazz and contemporary music.
Oh, really?
Music. Yeah,
I didn't know
absolutely.
That.
And all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You're so well known as a crime novelist, John Harvey, but perhaps what's less well known and rather less lucrative is that you're also a poet, and many of your poems are about music and musicians. When you're reading your poems, you often perform with a jazz band accompanying you, and I wonder how that works and what the music brings.
Yes, I mean, I've been very fortunate over the last 15 or more years, in fact, to read with a band in the East Midlands area around Nottinghamshire. And more recently, I've started reading with a band on the South Coast, doing jazz and poetry. For me, it's great, you know. I mean, I get to stand up on stage with really good musicians and hear them improvising around me. And
you do the relatively easy bit.
Exactly. Well, I do have to count. I have to know when I'm coming to the end of 32 bars or when the middle eight is coming in or whatever. But that apart, it is absolutely the easy bit, yeah.
So this is really the frustrated jazz musician bursting forth.
Oh, I think it is, without any doubt.
It'd be really nice if you could read us one of the poems in your new volume of selected poems, Out of Silence. And this is about that extraordinary, troubled trumpeter, Chet Baker.
Yes, yes, who was a wonderful talent, but you know, suffered like a lot of jazz musicians of his era did from drug use. Also kind of oddly suffered from being an incredibly handsome young man because people were often trying to divert him into other areas. And then he had that very strange early death. He fell, slight question mark after the verb there, from the hotel window in Amsterdam where he was staying and died on the pavement below. And there's never been a really satisfactory explanation of how or why that happened.
Well, let's hear then the poem about Chet Baker. Would you like to read that now?
Chet Baker looks out from his hotel room across the Amstel to the girl cycling by the canal who lifts her hand and waves. And when she smiles, he is back in times when every Hollywood producer wanted to turn his life into that bittersweet story where he falls badly, but only in love with Pierre-Angélie, Carol Linley, Natalie Wood. That day he strolled into the studio, Fall of 52, and played those perfect lines across the chords of My Funny Valentine. And now, when he looks up from his window and her passing smile into the blue of a perfect sky, he knows this is one of those days when he can truly fly.
To accompany that, we're going to hear a track that features Chet Baker on a recording by Elvis Costello in 1983.
Yes, apparently Baker was in London doing a gig and Costello went to hear him. The recording session, as I understand, had already been set up. And he asked Baker, who probably didn't know him from Adam, whether he would come along. I think he paid him normal session rates, if the story is right. And he played this beautiful, tumbling obbligato at the end, which is slightly manoeuvred electronically, I think, to give it a special effect. But I think it works so beautifully.
Is it worth it? And you and a coat and shoes for the wife, and a bicycle on the boy's birthday. It's just a rumor that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding. Boy said, Dad, they're going to take me to task. But I'll be back by Christmas. It's just a rumor that was spread around town. somebody said that someone got killed in for saying that people get killed in the result of this ship with all the will in the world diving for dear life, and we could be diving for
That's beautiful, isn't it? Mm.
Elvis Costello and Chet Baker with Shipbuilding from 1983, a political protest song about the Falklands War. Within weeks, they'll be opening the shipyards and notifying the next of kin. So that's the paradox of war, bringing back prosperity to the shipyards as ships are destroyed and men lost. Actually, you probably noticed this too, that I thought that, of course, he makes a wonderful sound, but he sounds slightly constrained within the kind of, you know, regular metre. So there yes. wasn't the opportunity to play across the bar line and to syncopate as much as he would normally do.
No, I think that's true. He's very much kind of fulfilling a particular function. But it did give me a chance to get the Elvis Costello song in as well as Chet Baker.
Yeah, great. And, of course, that is something which is so important to you in your writing, I think, that you like to embrace political and social issues. For example, Darkness, your latest novel, Darkness, Darkness, which I've just enjoyed reading very much, set in Nottingham, and it's about the legacy of the miners' strike and the deep divisions it caused, which in this case led to a murder. Is there a political agenda to a lot of your crime fiction?
I don't know about agenda, but there's a point of view. I think I would hope that people reading the Resnick book, say, about Nottingham, would be under no illusion as to where my basic political allegiances lay.
And is there a geographical loyalty to Nottingham?
Well, there is. I mean, I've lived in Nottingham off and on for about 20 years, probably. I first went there to teach. I taught in Heena. They don't pronounce it like that, but it's the best I can do, which is a small mining town outside Nottingham. After I finished training, I went and I taught there for a number of years before moving away and then going back. And I feel very attached to the place, as a community, they've always been very welcoming of me, very welcoming of the books and so on. So, yes, there is a very kind of strong attachment to that area. And that's why I felt writing about the miners' strike was a good thing to do, a necessary thing to do, in fact.
It's an area which has true grit in it, isn't it? Not to mention
it just
true crime.
Yes, indeed it is. Yes, well, Friday night or a Saturday night in the town centre of Nottingham, or Mansfield, should we say, is not for the faint-hearted.
Well, there's a degree of darkness in this next music, which is by the father of the conductor we heard earlier, Maxim Shostakovich, because it's Dmitri Shostakovich. And I'm really interested that you've chosen the second cello concerto rather than the first, which we all hear because it's got that very wonderful opening. Bum, 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 ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. You've chosen the second, though, which is played less frequently, I'd say.
The reason is the first time I ever heard this, I was driving across from the A1 towards the Lake District. Night was settling in. I had this a cassette of the second cello concerto in the car. It started, it sounds like it's made up, but it's not. It started raining. You could see the kind of clouds lowering around you as dusk fell. And this piece of music, the first movement especially, which is full of foreboding, I think, just seemed absolutely perfect to me. And I've really liked it ever since.
And also the soloist is very important to you.
This is a soloist called Sol Gabetta, who comes from Argentina, although I think her parents were French and Russian, who, in fact, my daughter Molly and I first saw playing the Elgar Cello Concerto a couple of years ago. One of the nice things about being, Michael, about being an older father with a younger daughter is that you get to re-listen and re-explore pieces of music that you probably listened to first 30, 40 years before. So we also went to hear Gabetta playing the Shostakovich. Molly, being a student of history, is very into Shostakovich, and it was just a wonderful performance, I thought.
Thank you.
It's very lonely music, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, yes. Just right for making a late, dark entrance into the Lake District, I think.
And she makes a beautiful sound.
The sound is fabulous, isn't it?
I think it's a Guadagnini cello she uses, and the actual tone is very beautiful. Sol Gobetta was the soloist in the opening of Shostakovich's second cello concerto, a work written like his first for Rostropovich, with the Munich Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Mark Albrecht. I think he really struggled when writing that piece, Shostakovich. At one point he began again from scratch. He junked one movement, the last movement. You've been very prolific as a writer, John, but I wonder if you do find sometimes that either the next chapter just won't come or that the last one was simply isn't right.
Of course it happens, and you do your best to go back and mend it. I suppose, unlike Shostakovich, in my writing life, because I've always been a commercial writer, there have always been deadlines, so that there are occasions, I hesitate to admit it on air, but I will, when I have been aware of passages or even chapters that maybe aren't quite as good as they should be, which have kind of slid through. The nice thing about my writing career, in a way, is that as it's gone on, I've been able to give more time to individual books. So, you know, nowadays, I think that wouldn't happen. In the early days, when I was writing Westerns at the rate of 12 a year, heaven knows what happened to those in terms of the quality of the style and so on.
Yeah, I mean, early on in your career, you wrote under a lot of different pseudonyms, all kinds of titles, didn't you, with very lurid covers sometimes. Are you almost Pulp Fiction?
No, absolutely Pulp Fiction, not almost Pulp Fiction. But it was great because it was like being paid to practice.
Well, the thing is that that's exactly the point, isn't it? That you're always honing your craft,
yes,
as a writer.
Absolutely, and the more you write, you know, hopefully, the better you get.
I mean, I've always thought, for example, as a composer, anybody, no matter how contemporary their idiom, should be able to write a simple tune which sticks in the mind, like a hymn tune or something.
Yes.
Because it's part of the craft of being a composer.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, being able to tell a story, it sounds kind of obvious, but there are writers out there whose storytelling is not perhaps always what it should be.
And there are some composers who can't write a tune. a tango next, but one with a difference.
Yes, this is, to me, a wonderful piece of music, a wonderful collage. I first became interested in collage in music, the use of voices and instrumentation, listening to Brian Eno and David Byrne's My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. And more recently, I've really been enjoying a lot of Steve Reich. I went to a performance of his Different Trains piece recently, for instance, which is wonderful, I think, really haunting use of voices from the Holocaust period and so on. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity there by using voices and sampling and so on to get a real kind of depth to music, both emotionally and in terms of the story it's telling.
So what is the piece you've chosen?
This is a Jocelyn Pook composition called Tango with Corrugated Iron, which I think was written for a film that was being made on the outskirts of London called Blight. And what she does is to use the voices of Londoners mixed in with some tango music and some corrugated iron.
28th of June, 1907.
16th of September, 1916.
70 now.
I'm 88.
Jordan and Kim. Jordan and Kim.
Number is 27.
74.
23rd of the 5th, 73.
January the 20th, 1990.
266.
I'll be 68 in December.
47. Coming up 48.
7 years. 7 years. Yeah.
Jordan and Kim. Jordan and Kim.
Jocelyn Pook's tango with corrugated iron, performed by the Electra Strings. An interesting use there of real everyday sounds. Do you use real crime in your novels, John Harvey? I mean, for example, do you go to the Old Bailey or consult real detectives or police? Or
I consult the pages of the Nottingham Post.
It's wonderful what one can find in local newspapers. I mean, humour as well as crime. I always remember laughing seeing an advertisement in the Mid Wales Journal, Farmer Seeks Girlfriend, Must Have Tractor. so likely. When you started writing novels back in the 80s, crime novels, John, there was a certain sense of how it might be, but it's all become much more violent since then, hasn't it?
It has, and it's something I'm pretty unhappy about, actually. I don't like the way there almost seems to be a competition for who can have the most violent and, you know, disgusting crime in their books, and what awful things can you do? Unfortunately, also, what awful things can you do to female victims rather than male victims? And I fight very shy of that as much as I can, and it's one area of crime writing in the crime writing community generally that I'm not happy about at all.
You've decided that your most recent crime novel is probably going to be your last. So you've retired dear old Charlie Resnick after 25 years.
I thought he deserved it, really.
He's more and more, anyway, isn't he, a witness?
Yes.
Understanding less and less of the world, moving fast around him.
And something else we have in common, I suspect.
Yes, as you both reach your eighth decade. You retire Resnick rather than killing him off, and you leave him in a good place, sitting on a bench in Nottingham, nursing a coffee, planning what jazz track to go home and listen to. In your words, hankering after a fresh helping of Thelonious Monk. And maybe that's where we should finish, but of course we haven't heard any Monk yet.
Absolutely. Well, save the good things till last, save the best. I've chosen a Monk piece called Rhythm and Ink, because I think it's quite an upbeat way to finish. And I like this particular composition, not least because when I do get to do my jazz and poetry readings, I always contrive to read something while this is playing.
John Harvey, thank you.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. Thelonious Monk with Rhythm and Ing, recorded in 1962, and the choice of Michael Barclay's guest today, John Harvey. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus production for Radio 3. If you missed any of the programme or you'd like to hear others in the series, you can download Private Passions if you go to the podcasts page of the Radio 3 website. Well, next week at the same time, Michael's guest will be the theatre director and artistic director at the RSC, Greg Doran.
The very best of orchestral and chamber music from around the UK. Live in concert, the best seat in the house. Next Friday, we're live in concert at Manchester's Bridgewater Hall. The BBC Philharmonic and their principal guest conductor Jon Storgods give a performance of Nielsen's sometimes capricious flute concerto, as well as works by Tchaikovsky, his fantasy overture on Hamlet, and the fifth symphony that takes the listener on a dramatic journey from tragedy to triumph. That's live in concert from Manchester, 7:30 next Friday, here on BBC Radio 3. Listen again for 30 days online in HD sound.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome to Radio 3. This is Ian Skelly here guiding you through our music and programmes this afternoon. The music continues in just a moment with our lunchtime concert. Piano music, in fact, by Beethoven and Chopin, played by Garrick Olson. That's our live lunchtime concert that we broadcast last Monday on Radio 3. 1 o'clock now, though. Time for a summary of the BBC News. It's read by Susan Ray.
The extremist group calling itself Islamic State is claiming to have killed a fifth Western hostage who was kidnapped in Syria last year. 26-year-old Peter Kasich, an American who converted to Islam, had set up an organisation which trained civilians so they could provide medical aid. A video by Islamic State appears to show a beheading having taken place. Intelligence services in the United States are trying to confirm the authenticity of the film. David Cameron described Mr. Kasich as a selfless humanitarian worker and said he would be horrified if he had been murdered. Mr. Cameron was speaking following the end of the G20 summit of world leaders in Australia. They agreed to introduce a package of measures over the next 5 years, which they hope will increase global economic growth by 2.1%. Pledges were also made on tax avoidance and tackling climate change in the developing world. But the meeting in Brisbane was overshadowed by tensions between the West and Russia because of President Putin's intervention in Ukraine. David Cameron said it would be a test of stamina to keep up the pressure on Moscow, but one Europe and America would meet. The former Conservative Prime Minister, Sir John Major, has suggested that Mr. Cameron's plans to impose limits on migrants from the European Union might only be for the short term. Sir John said there had been increased migration to the UK because of economic difficulties in southern Europe, and once those countries were back in growth, the demand to come to the UK would almost certainly fall. Three teenagers have been killed in a car crash last night near Doncaster. Two others died following the accident. A man was arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving. The Dutch authorities say they've identified a strain of bird flu at a poultry farm. 150,000 hens are being destroyed at the farm in the village of Hekendorp in the central Netherlands. No details have been given of what strain of bird flu has been found. And the weather, most places will be dry this afternoon, but the odd light shower is possible, especially in Wales and southwest England. Cloud will build in the east later, with rain moving into East Anglia and Lincolnshire by the evening. And that's the BBC News and weather. It's just coming up to 1:03.
Susan, thank you very much. Well, in an hour from now, Piers Adams explores the work of the Dutch conductor and flautist Frans Bruggen, who died in August this year at the age of 79. He co-founded the Orchestra of the 18th Century and he conducted the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment many times. So an assessment of his legacy and a great deal of his music making in the Early Music Show at 2 this afternoon. But first, a chance to hear the lunchtime concert we broadcast live here on Radio 3 last Monday. It was presented by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Wigmore Hall. Garrick Olson is the only American to have won the famous Chopin International Piano Competition in Warsaw, which would perhaps be unremarkable, except that that was over 40 years ago. He is one of the finest pianists of his generation, and today he's playing music for us here at Wigmore Hall at the Radio 3 lunchtime concert by both Chopin and Beethoven. He's recorded and performed a vast amount of music by both composers. We'll be hearing Chopin's third sonata in the second half of the recital, but he starts with one of Beethoven's late works, the first of his last three sonatas, number 30 in E major. In this sonata, it's as though Beethoven leaves the slow movement until last. The first two movements are short and relatively lively, and then the third lasts over 10 minutes. It begins with a melody in three time, a dance, perhaps a saraband, beautiful, bittersweet and tender. And from that melody, Beethoven then spins a sequence of variations, which become ever more dense and wildly inventive, until the keyboard becomes thick with trills. And then we hear the yearning melody again in its original form, as the sonata tails off into silence. Here comes Garrick Olsen now to begin his lunchtime recital with Beethoven's Sonata No. 30 in E major, opus 109.